You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease Du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Lindsay Goodale about the intersection of equine welfare and veterinary medicine. This episode of Disease Du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Goodale is a senior lecturer in the Department of Animal Science at Cornell's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. In this role, she teaches undergraduate and graduate students courses in equine biology and management, domestic mammalian behavior, and animal welfare. Dr. Goodale also serves as the equine extension specialist for New York State and has developed a horse farm improvement program for equine operations. She attended veterinary school at Cornell and graduated in 2012, returning to work at Cornell in her current role in 2017. She is pursuing board certification through the American College of Animal Welfare and owns an off-track thoroughbred named Fig who enjoys clicker training. Thank you, Dr. Goodale, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
To start us out, can you give us an overview of how you believe equine welfare and veterinary medicine should intersect?
Yeah, so my initial thoughts on this were that obviously to a large degree they already do. Animal welfare, of course, is like a bit broader. So the most kind of basic definition of animal welfare is just how an animal experiences its life. So that can be a range of negative and positive experiences. And if you're kind of trying to define animal welfare through a framework, which is a pretty popular way of doing it, just because it's, I think, a little easier to conceptualize that way, one of the most popular ones is the five domains framework. And so that framework helps us think of animal welfare as being essentially an animal's mental state, which is the fifth domain. And that mental state is affected by the four other domains. So that's nutrition, environment, health. And then the fourth domain is behavioral interaction. So that means like with the horse's interaction with the environment, other people, other horses, other people, horses and other people. And so obviously veterinary medicine is mostly focused, at least traditionally, on that third domain of health. And so that's, of course, pretty well covered in vet school anyways. And I think there is increasingly some acknowledgement, though, that we can, I think, better serve our patients if we try whenever possible to also consider the other domains. And of course, we don't have as much training in some of those areas, although, of course, everyone can have special interests, for example, like in nutrition or maybe facility design or something like that. And you can do CE in those areas. But I think at least starting with acknowledging that the whole animal's experience of life is important to them and that all of those four domains affect the mental state, I think that's probably a good first step. Even if you don't, let's say, or maybe you're not personally interested in perhaps equine nutrition, perfectly fine. I think just at least knowing that it is pretty important to the animal's well-being, their environment, all of that. I don't think we necessarily need to be experts in all those pieces, but understanding that they are quite important. And when you can, you know, it's not always possible, when you can, talking to owners about those things and to the degree possible, trying to influence all of them so that your patients have the best welfare possible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a good overview.
Yeah.
Are there any aspects of welfare or behavior that you think are maybe commonly overlooked in veterinary practice where there are easy adjustments that could be made for improvement, if that makes sense?
That's a good question. I think, I suppose it might depend a lot on what you find easy or, to be honest, interesting, just because I think it's easier for us to get really into like CE or extra learning on stuff we're interested in. So I guess for all of my students, I usually just encourage them to pick what it is they're interested in and then pursue that, because you know, you don't want to spend your life working on stuff you're not as interested in. For me, I am super interested in behavior especially. And so that's really helped me quite a bit in terms of even just basic interactions with horses, even non-patients, and has really opened up my eyes, I think, especially because I think it's fairly common in the equine industry to, for example, grow up in a barn where you know, a lot of maybe, let's say, handling or management practices were maybe now we would call them outdated or not as supported by scientific evidence. And so I grew up in barns like that. I think a lot of us did. And it's, you know, because we're into science as vets, I think it's the best way to kind of get educated on that is just to read the science, because that's the fun way to do it. And I've done a lot of that reading. I think increasingly some of the common ways to consider welfare and behavior in working with equine patients are kind of the increasing popularity of like fear-free handling techniques, low stress handling, stuff like that. Fear-free, the company does have an equine module now, I think as of a handful of years ago, which I've taken and I thought was quite interesting. I know that at Cornell, at least I believe all of the equine hospital technicians have taken that. I would encourage all students, vets, vet techs, anyone working with horses really to take either that program or some kind of similar program, even if it's just, you know, free webinars or something in the area. It could really, first of all, increase the horse's welfare, but I think equally as important, increase the safety of the people working with the horses, which then if you're safe and you feel calm, then I think that's like a positive spiral towards the horse also feeling safer and calmer and everything just going a little bit easier. And I think sometimes as vets, we feel pressure to get something done, especially if the owner maybe is pressuring us to do so, or maybe your boss or just the circumstances, maybe you're overwhelmed. And it can be, you know, I've definitely felt situations where I felt pressured to get into the trailer with the down horse or something like that. And so I think keeping in mind your safety is so important in equine practice. And I think knowing a lot about equine behavior and learning theory and applying as much of that as possible, really, really helpful for the horse's sake, which we're all, of course, we value. And then also just for all the people working with the horse. Super important, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know a big piece of some of these welfare discussions is agency. Can you explain what it means to give a horse agency? And does that apply at all to veterinary medicine?
Yeah, for sure. And I think probably the easiest way to understand agency is just to think of the three C's, because they're easier to remember, I think. So those, the three C's of agency are usually listed as choice, control, and challenge. And so that basically means like the ability to choose between options. What do you want to eat today? When do you want to eat? Do you want to do this now or later? What side do you prefer this happen on? Something, any choice you can give any animal, including people. And then control, meaning like effectively control outcomes. So being able to predict what's going to happen if you do X, Y, or Z, for example. You know, if someone asks me to do it this way, I know I always am expected to do this response and not have multiple handlers having different expectations and then getting frustrated with you, for example. And then challenge, that can be interpreted a lot of ways, but we of course mean, it's hard to define, but like positive challenge, not scary challenge that's like flooding the animal or overwhelming them. And instead, it's just giving them an opportunity. For the most extreme example of having no challenge would be like living in a barren environment. So you can picture like a lab animal in an empty cage with nothing to interact with. That animal's life has not a lot going on, really. And if you can let the animal challenge themselves, again, not with really stressful challenges, but with small things to figure out or to work through, or maybe like varied terrain or a new training task or something like that, then the process of kind of like working it out for themselves and learning can actually build resilience. It's true in people too. And so then if they do encounter a stressor later, they're actually a lot more able to handle that because they've encountered some challenge before. And again, just really, really emphasize that it's positive challenge. Yeah. And so there's a lot of cool literature I can share with you later if you ever share resources, but a lot of cool ideas, I think. And I do have a talk on a similar subject. If you want me to get into more of that, I certainly can.
Yeah, we can definitely share some of those resources in the show notes below for anyone who's interested in learning more. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think I didn't comment on how that can intersect with vet med.
Yeah.
I do think it's harder because depending on the type of medicine you're practicing, like ambulatory versus in hospital, sometimes it's like, okay, well, I've shown up for a vaccine appointment for this 8-horse barn. What do you want me to do here? You know, but I think having conversation with the owner, especially like at annual visits where maybe you have time to chat a little bit, can be super helpful. In part, really encouraging owners to learn about and be empowered to use positive reinforcement training is a really big way to increase horses' agency. And then you can use that, they can use it during appointments. And so again, I go back to the, it's increasing agency for the horse. They can say when they're ready or comfortable for something, for example, if you train them to do that. And the huge benefit to the vet is also that then you're a lot safer. And we've all had appointments where you wish that, you know, you could get into that with the owner. And there are resources you can share with the owner. I can share some of those. But positive reinforcement training. And also, I think just there's, depending on your practice location or maybe your clientele, there can be a little bit of a stigma around some of these ways of interacting with horses that might seem come across as like soft or maybe not as traditional or sometimes are maybe seen as ineffectual, or especially if you then bring up treats or feeding, I think a lot of people can get worried that it might worsen behavior. And certainly that's a distinct possibility if it's not done appropriately. And so I definitely wouldn't encourage the use of a lot of these tools unless you're comfortable with them and know something about equine learning theory and become comfortable with that. But it's not that hard. Once you learn it and learn, you know, the quadrants of operant conditioning stuff and practice it a little bit, you can become confident really quickly with it. I have a class of undergraduate students who take an equine class I teach, and they each have their group has a horse for the whole semester. And they, you know, assess the horse's behavior, develop a training plan based on equine learning theory, and then train it throughout the semester. And then we have some goals and stuff and have a little horse show at the end. And it's, you know, they're only doing it for a few hours at the beginning of the semester that they're learning this stuff, and they get really good at it. So I think if it's of interest to you and you'd like to integrate into your practice, it's definitely possible.
Yeah. And I think sometimes it's surprising how quickly horses adapt to some of these new
methods. Oh, they're very good at learning it. Yeah. But it is the reason you want to be comfortable with it before launching into it. I've definitely seen super well-intentioned people who are just excited about a new technique and maybe aren't aware of some of the pitfalls to keep an eye out for. And so you just want to get a solid base. And I'd say a couple hours of studying is usually plenty. And ideally, if there's some kind of person who can mentor you through your first couple interactions with horses using that, you know, make sure the horse has, you train them using treat manners, that kind of stuff, then yeah, you're ready to go and you can use it for the rest of your career. And I really think it's super useful.
Yeah, that's great. This podcast is brought to you by Equithrive. Equithrive manufactures two science-backed formulas that support metabolic health and easy keepers. Medicare pellets combine resveratrol with flavonoids and amino acids for optimum carbohydrate metabolism, healthy body weight, and appropriate insulin levels in horses of all ages and breeds. Metaverol pellets deliver the largest serving of resveratrol available in the market and is the go-to product for horses requiring maximum metabolic support. When metabolic health is priority number one, trust Equithrive. Use promo code DUJOUR, that's DUJOUR, to get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping at equithrive.com. So I guess shifting focus a little bit, what are some practical ways that vets can assess a horse's welfare state during exams?
Definitely. Yeah. And so I guess the good news is that we're already quite good at assessing their physical health. So that's usually pretty well covered. So go team. And then I think if you're interested in a more holistic assessment of their welfare, there are a lot of ways you can do that. I guess it depends a little bit, like I said before, on your interests. And then also maybe if you do have any particular concerns for that case, or if you're just generally kind of wanting to put that, let's say, for example, like as a piece of your annual exam, that you're going to do a bit more holistic of a welfare assessment. There are a lot of ways you could integrate it. a lot of it can be achieved through what you're already being done and just expanding that a little bit. So a thorough history that includes, to be honest, a lot of stuff we'll inquire about anyways. So like diet, how are they living, observing where they're living, how they act in their environment, and observing the horse in its environment, which again, it depends on, you know, where you are, right? If you're working in a hospital, that part's harder and then you have to rely on history mostly. Or if maybe the horses live out and are brought up to you to a barn to examine or something like that, then of course some of these are a little harder. But when you can, if you can observe them in their environment, maybe after they're put back out, for example, after your exam and you're chatting with the owner or something, then that can help a lot. So just like a few examples of stuff you might be looking for and you might notice already. So for example, like if they're in the stall, are they displaying any stereotypic behavior while you're standing outside of the stall, not engaging with them yet? A big one that's actually a part of a lot of formal welfare assessments is if you approach the stall, what does the horse do? And the ideal that gives us a sense that maybe they have had positive interactions with people as if they approach the front of the stall door. If they either go to the back and don't want to approach you or seem to be unaware of your approach or uninterested and don't engage with people, those can be signs. Obviously, these aren't foolproof, but it's you're building a picture, right? Those can be signs that maybe the horse either has had, like I said, negative experiences with people, or on an extreme end might be experiencing learned helplessness where they kind of feel that their actions have no consequences. And so they kind of just stop acting on their environment or interacting with people. So some of it can be kind of simple where you're just noticing what happens if you do XYZ. And then you can also try to just keep in mind some of the big pieces that affect a horse's welfare. Of course, there are an infinite list that, you know, but a few of the biggest pieces, you might have heard of the three Fs of equine welfare, the freedom, friends, and forage. That means freedom to move as they would like, so they can achieve all three gates, for example. Friends, so they have access to conspecifics, other horses. And forage, so they have, to the degree allowed by their, you know, physical state, their health condition, to the degree of available, they have access to forage. And that could be pasture, it could be hay, any kind of forage, really. So a thinking, if you just think of those as, okay, I can't have a whole, whatever, 3-hour formal welfare assessment on this whole barn, but maybe I can just talk to the owner about the three Fs and see how they're doing on those fronts and what kind of support maybe they could use or ideas, then, you know, turnout in terms of freedom, and that can also address the friends piece and the forage piece. So if they have good pasture turnout, honestly, that's, you're checking a lot of boxes already. And again, that's not always possible, right, for every horse, but when it is, that's a big, really big contributor to horse welfare. Ideal is 24/7 turnout in terms of like evolutionarily what the horse was kind of built for and how they psychologically prefer to live. And then in part also just because when left to their own devices, horses spend about 16 hours a day grazing, and it's hard to allow for that if they're in a stall much. And then allowing at least 12 hours of turnout, plenty of papers have shown that that also helps reduce risk of injury, which a lot of owners don't realize. They're worried it's the opposite. But we've shown in a few studies, and actually a couple came out recently, one of which was co-authored by someone at Cornell, Dr. Demester. And they showed that if you have the most turnout you have, and this is including for foals, young horses, and adults, you're really reducing the risk of injury. And the reason sometimes people associate turnout with increased risk of injury, for example, like running and bucking and then hurting themselves, is that because it's such a kind of inherently desired behavior for horses to be grazing and moving constantly, if you keep them in a stall really for any amount of time and then release them, there's rebound activity, meaning an increase above baseline than if you hadn't stalled them at all. And so when you turn them out, we've all seen this, right? Even if they haven't been in super long, then they will have rebound activity. And sometimes that's when they're most likely to be injured. And again, be understanding, of course, that your clients, a lot of people just board where they can and have sometimes very little control over a lot of this stuff. But to the degree possible, sometimes it's just that owners aren't aware of the benefits of XYZ. Maybe they don't know that they could, for example, transition some of their horse's diet from concentrates to forage, and that could have a lot of benefits. So I think, you know, read the room, but try to figure out maybe what are some areas where in this particular case, this horse could have these improvements that you're aware of, and, you know, just as diplomatically as possible, seeing what they know about, what might benefit their situation specifically. Right. And then, sorry, more broadly, I just wanted to say that also learning about equine body language and facial expression, and then also helping owners to understand that, can be a big deal. Applying the Ridden Horse Pain Ethogram by Sue Dyson can be really helpful. So you can incorporate that into lameness exams in addition to performing the lameness exam itself, and using either subjective or objective lameness evaluation techniques. You can also apply the ethogram that Sue Dyson developed and look for other kind of signs of pain that might not just be seen musculoskeletally.
Right. Can you talk about how that might apply to managing chronic pain or long-term disease or illness?
Yes. So I think in terms of managing chronic pain and chronic illness, I think what usually springs to mind in terms of like ways to assess that is the quality of life assessment scales. Right. And for whatever reason, quality of life is more or less synonymous with welfare. It's just that for whatever reason, colloquially, we often use it to kind of think of like you said, chronic pain or maybe end of life decision making.
Right.
And so a lot of times, and there's plenty of papers on this and a lot of resources online, happy to share some of those resources too. So utilizing some of those questionnaires or quality of life assessment forms can help a lot. I also think that something that's super useful when you're managing a case, especially over a long time, and you start to question yourself a little bit, like, are we making a difference here? You know, is Sparky really improving, or has he kind of been declining over the past few months? And maybe you see him a couple times a week managing his laminitis or something, whatever it is. Sometimes just bringing in another vet, maybe a colleague, maybe even not on the farm, but just as a consult, that can really help you. Just because it's human nature, it's hard for us to notice changes if we see the patient really frequently. And so bringing in someone else and saying, can you just look at this with fresh eyes and maybe give them the tool you've been using to assess, or just kind of present the case to them, maybe some videos or something. And if they say, oh, this is not looking great, you know, and they can be honest with you, that can help a lot, because I think we can get bogged down in seeing the animal really frequently. And then also, of course, you become emotionally attached to yourself, and maybe you and the owner start to get in kind of on the same path, kind of. Yeah. Having an outside opinion can help a lot with that. And then also, because delayed euthanasia is seen as one of the most important welfare issues affecting horses, a few studies of like experts have identified that as a big concern, delayed euthanasia. So I think making sure everyone's aware that that's on the table when it, especially if it's in pain, the horse is in pain, that's always should always be on the table. And I think the last thing I want to mention about that is that you also want to make sure to check in on the owner's well-being. So managing a chronic disease in a horse is quite taxing. And, you know, it's obviously emotionally taxing, but it can be quite physically taxing as well. And as we all know, it can be financially draining. And so I think also checking in on how they're doing and making sure they know that euthanasia is an option when the horse is not doing well. Even if you do a quality of life assessment and it's a little in the gray area, or maybe someone thinks they could help the horse, you have to check in on the owner too and see how everyone's doing and assess not just the horse, but like the situation holistically. So I think that's important too.
How can veterinarians incorporate behavior modification principles and low stress handling techniques to make care a little bit safer and more pleasant for everyone involved?
Gotcha. Yeah. So I think lots of opportunities. And I think you can do this. There's potential to make these changes on a really big scale. So for example, like maybe changes at your hospital or a Holland facility you have, practice policies you have, client education efforts that you undertake as a practice, or on a smaller scale. So like talking to an owner during an appointment, individual vet CE. So there's a whole range of approaches you could take depending on, you know, your interests and your client's interest. And a lot of research has consistently shown that owners on average, of course, there are plenty of exceptions, owners on average have a fairly poor understanding of equine learning theory and behavior modification tools. And so if you're seeing them a lot, then you can be a great resource for that. And so I think that's good enough a place to start as any. There's definitely a few articles I'd really recommend if this is a subject area of interest to you. There are a couple on fear-free husbandry and vet care for horses, and then also kind of some more recent publications on understanding and treating equine behavioral problems. We also have a veterinary behaviorist at Cornell, Dr. Kate Anderson, who is a great resource for this. And she actually gave a seminar for our Cornell Equine Seminar Series on a few of these ideas last year, I think. I can share that with you. And she discusses a lot of these approaches you can take. And I think in general, there are, again, I think you just decide what level do you want to maybe make these changes at, or what's your personal interest area, and then just pursuing a little CE in that area. And also, I think it can help to talk to some colleagues who've maybe done these things in their practice, in part just so you don't feel like you're launching out on your own, kind of. Right. And there are some cool examples and resources, videos. Gemma Pearson in the UK has a lot of resources on this. Plenty of people interested and psyched about it. I'm happy to talk to anyone who cares, you know. Right. Plenty of people are passionate about it and I think would be happy to chat with people.
So how can welfare principles help veterinarians in situations where a horse is resistant or reacts negatively to a procedure?
Yeah, I think one of the important considerations we can take from animal welfare science when we're dealing with that kind of clinical situation as vets is just the general idea of holistically assessing the animal in the situation. So, you know, of course, there's always a reason that any animal behaves in any particular way, and understanding that helps us a lot to know how best do we then address it. And so veterinary behavior, I think, is a field that's helped me quite a bit just in kind of everyday interactions with animals, whether it's clinical or not. And so I think for me, one of the most helpful, there are, of course, a lot of great papers on tools you can specifically utilize or approaches for specific behavior problems and like understanding their origin or cause and then how to kind of treat them. I think one of the broader principles that's most helpful, and I think we can also model for our clients, the owners, is this idea of not labeling animals or pets, and instead using as much as we can kind of a clinical discussion of their behavior that's as objective as possible. And I'll give some examples, but one of the reasons it's so important is that studies have shown that if we label animals, especially if we assign blame or kind of malintent on the part of the animal, it predisposes people to punishing the animal, which then of course worsens their welfare. And it turns out also worsens our mental well-being. And so that, plus we're clinicians. And so I think thinking of it that way is helpful because that's what we're trained to do anyways. And I know that Dr. Sue McDonnell, who's at UPenn, along with Dr. Cade Torcivia, have talked about this some, and some of their examples are quite helpful, I think. So it's essentially a way of both using the language yourself, but then also kind of modeling it for owners and encouraging them to do so too, is instead of saying like, oh, that stupid mare is a real witch about her meds or something, that's not super helpful. And also kind of implies the scheming or something, which they're not really capable of. And instead use an empathetic statement of the problem. So for example, that would be like, I'm having difficulty administering this mare's oral meds. Okay, great. This gives us also like somewhere to go with the information. And then also, this is kind of the clinical aspect, is in veterinary behavior, you would just want to provide like the most specific and precise definition or description you can of what is the avoidance behavior they're displaying, what's this undesirable behavior they're displaying, whatever it is. So let's say when I approached her with the syringe, she raised her head, causing her to scoot backwards, and then she reared. So that gives us a lot more, instead of just saying, oh, she was being a witch or something, that's not helpful and also unfairly kind of making the animal seem, some people will say, oh, she's evil or she doesn't like people. And then it kind of, unfortunately, they get kind of categorized and then their behaviors aren't appropriately dealt with and their welfare really takes a hit. And so instead, trying to understand why are they doing this by first having an empathetic statement of what's going on, and then also an objective description of the behavior you're seeing, first of all, it can help you identify, okay, well, how do we safely do this then? If it's something that sounds really dangerous, then they advise they stop doing it and rethink, you know, the approach. And then also it can start to help you identify what is it, for example, that is triggering the behavior. Is it the sight of the oral syringe? Is it she's fine until it gets in her mouth and then she tastes it? Is it the person administering it? Is it, you know, and you can kind of figure out what it is specifically that's causing so much fear and reactivity in the horse. Then that's what really helps you kind of dive down into as to possible causes and create a behavior modification plan that's helpful, makes everyone safer. And then also, of course, the horse isn't kind of abandoned into, oh, they're terrible for this. You just have to, whatever, put the twitch on them for it. And instead, you can help the owner, even if you're not comfortable creating a training plan yourself, you can either refer to a veterinary behaviorist or a trainer who's really well-versed in positive reinforcement training or has the CAAB moniker. That doesn't sound right. The CAAB training. And I can't think what it's called. And so referring to specialists is always an option. And then, or if it's an interest area of yours, then definitely reading up a little and figuring out how to deal with some of the more common behavior problems can be really empowering. It improves the horse's welfare, and then it definitely everyone's safety as well.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Avoid falling into the chestnut mare syndrome of, you know, dismissing behaviors because of the type of horse that you're working with. I think
exactly. So. We want to avoid that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've touched on this a lot throughout the episode, but do you have any specific strategies that you recommend for how veterinarians can start to communicate some of these principles with their clients, especially when they require management changes?
Yes. And it's hard, right? And before I got into animal welfare science, I didn't know much about this. And I think it's honestly one of the biggest reasons that people get frustrated when studying either behavior or welfare is that it's like, okay, well, I learned all this stuff and now I have to convince an owner to do it. What do you expect me to do? Or just anyone, convince anyone to do anything is hard, right? And a lot of animal welfare scientists, I should say, there's now a field of animal welfare science that studies human behavior change scientifically. And it's really eye-opening to read about this. And I've attended a few talks on applying human behavior change, the study of it, to animal welfare, usually improving animal welfare. Super fascinating. A lot of really cool tools that we've taken basically from psychology to determine mostly how do we convince people to change their behavior? Because, as I said, it's notoriously difficult. And there are a lot of cool resources I can share with you. I think the most useful framework in my mind is the COMBI framework. And so this is it's COMS-B. And so it's behavior change. You have to assess the person's capability, which is C, O for opportunity, and then M for motivation. So what is their capability to change? What opportunities do they have to change? And what are their motivations to either change or not change for displaying this behavior, basically? And you can look at any number of interventions and kind of using this COMBI approach, try to decide where am I best you know, you don't want to waste your time and effort if it's been shown not to be very effective. Right. And a lot of things, unfortunately, that we spend a lot of time doing aren't effective. And then we get frustrated and give up. So, you know, we want to study what helps. There are some cool studies, for example, on like how to advise farmers for making change. There was a really cool recent paper on how to convince farmers or exploring their behaviors related to improving lameness in livestock. And they found some, they identified some really common barriers to change, and then they identified some of the interventions that were most likely to be successful. And you can do that for a lot of different situations. I think for, if you're talking specifically about horse owners and as a vet, how do you recommend change to them and what's most likely to kind of make a difference? I think the biggest or kind of most straightforward target in my mind is addressing the owner's psychological capability. So that's the C in the combi to make change. So increasing their knowledge and understanding. And then also by providing social support and being kind of like a representative of the cultural norms that you think the equine industry should move towards. So for example, like speaking positively about low stress handling, modeling positive interactions with the horses yourself, stuff like that. So if you're then increasing their capability to make change and also their opportunity to do so, you can also kind of look at the, for every kind of environment you're in, look at their barn and their setup and try to think for this specific scenario, what are some kind of physical changes to the environment that would increase their opportunity to make change? So for example, how could this facility increase turnout for their horses? So not just broadly saying, oh yeah, you should turn them out more and then driving away, which of course sometimes you have to do because you don't have time. But if you're able to troubleshoot a little bit with them, you know, as a just a human being, it can be frustrating to get advice and no means of kind of applying that advice. And so whenever you can, just saying like, you could think about trying this if we're going to work on changing this, or have you thought about taking out these walls and maybe changing this to an open setup or whatever it is that's relevant for that farm, but being really specific. And then also being clear that you're considering their particular barriers and that you're trying to address them. And then also just kind of motivation is usually the hard one. Sometimes people are super motivated and they just don't know how, or there are economic barriers, which of course we can't do as much about. But sometimes you can just encourage them in a really open, non-judgmental way to promote reflection. And that can be done in a lot of ways. Essentially, you're just encouraging people to think about why we do some things. What are our motivations for doing those things? Are we open to change if we learn something new? If so, how can we support each other in doing that? So it's, I maybe went a little philosophical there, but it's a really interesting field. And I think there's a lot of potential for us to all be just less frustrated if we, you know, can learn from that field of psychology to say what will actually help people change. Because people want to do best by their horses almost always, right? And so just encouraging anytime you can, really.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point that you made about just being a model of the principles that you want to embody, because you might not always be able to affect tangible change in every situation, but maybe you'll just plant the seed in an owner's head or just start to make an impact on your horse community because you are a source of authority and someone that is respected. And hopefully those ideas will just get out there, even if you can't change every situation. So
for sure. Yeah, I agree.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add about welfare principles before we wrap up today?
I should maybe mention that there are, I think it can be overwhelming to just think of like, okay, I'll try to improve every horse's welfare I ever interact with. So if you're at least like me, I'm more of a like, okay, is there a form I can use? Is there a tool somewhere that's been validated? And there are forms like that. And so especially, for example, I mentioned the quality of life assessment forms. I can share some of those. There are also some programs to evaluate kind of whole farm, both horse welfare and then just the functioning of the farm more generally. So at Cornell, we have the Horse Farm Improvement Program, which I would recommend for anyone interested in improving the horse's welfare, but also the sustainability kind of like economically and environmentally of the farm and just the safety of their workers and all that. So that's kind of a more holistic approach. And then there are also kind of in terms of abuse and neglect cases, there are some resources. For example, AAP has some assessments to use in those circumstances, although I know they are being updated right now, but hopefully those will be available soon. And in general, I'm also happy to share with anyone who's interested, you know, scientific articles, if you're having trouble getting access to some. There are a lot of really cool resources, and I would say more and more every year. I'd say the field is accelerating animal welfare science, especially in the horse world.
Yeah, I know. It's great that it's becoming such a bigger focus, and I think that's really going to improve treatment outcomes and well-being for everyone. I will link those resources that you talked about in the show notes, so anyone who's interested can look there or reach out to you directly if they want to go a little bit deeper into any subject. Yeah, thank you so much again, Dr. Goodell, for joining this episode and sharing your field of expertise with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carly.
I'd like to say thank you again to Dr. Goodell for joining us, and thank you to Equithrive for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.